would like to ask our speaker getter, Rick, to come up and our amazing speaker getter, Rick, to come up and introduce tonight's speaker.
Thank you, Rick.
Thank you to our amazing leader, Phil. So, hi, my name is Rick, a proud member of Al-Anon. So we're continuing the amazing series of monthly meetings. So last month we had my good friend Bruce and his lovely wife Gita, both who have helped me a tremendous amount in this program. Tonight we have John. And John, I work with John a lot. And he has this amazing way of telling a story. I'll be so stuck on my problem saying, but John, what about this? And she did, and then what do I do? And John's like, you know, it's kind of like the frog who took off in an airplane. I'm like, what is he talking about? You're not listening to me. And then he goes on and he tells the story and he like ropes it back in, and I sit there and it hits me like straight between the eye. I'm like, oh, wow. That's what he's talking about. So he's an amazing storyteller. And I really learned a lot from him, and he's graciously afforded me a lot of his time and guidance and support. And he's an awesome man. So I'd like to introduce John.
Okay, thank you for the privilege of speaking to you all. And if I could get somebody to get me a glass of water, that would be nice. And then I have a couple little housekeeping things here. Normally I wash all the coffee mugs. I'm not doing that tonight. Somebody's higher power is going to take care of that. It's not that I don't like the commitment, but it's a wonderful commitment. And one of the best parts of it is when you completely washed all the mugs and you're starting to dry them, some guy always comes up with a mug. So that they get the gift of a resentment to work on. And that's always good, you know. So what I'm going to talk about tonight is the 12 steps, because the 12 steps have given me a framework for my life. And so we're going to work through these. Ice water too. Okay, good. So I'm going to thread these through my life. My family, it's an interesting family. Some of us are from Ireland, some of us are from Germany, some of us are from Wales. I don't know much about my family. My sister knows everything. I know that my great-grandfather was a hod carrier in Cork. A hod carrier is a guy who carries a pole with a V-shaped piece of wood on it, and they pile bricks on it. And I have a suspicion that drinking was involved. And I know that my two grandfathers both left the family. And one of my grandfathers had a raging temper, which is another trait of my family. We're good on the temper thing. And I know that these two women on both sides of the family had to raise that family pretty much themselves. And I also know that I have an aunt that came over from Ireland who was a genius at, she could look at a piece of machinery and design a cover for it. She could sew a cover for it. And she unfortunately was stunted by malnutrition because of poverty. So, you know, my family has a lot of the kind of things that contribute to alcoholism and Al-Anonism. My parents were, they got together in Berkeley, and one of the things that I didn't realize about my parents for a long time is that they had dreams. They each had personal dreams. And they weren't really able to fulfill those dreams to the full extent that they could. My mother dreamed of being an archaeologist. My father dreamed of being an engineer. And when he came back from serving in the Merchant Marine, he started an auto parts store. And so he put his life into that store. And my mom was the bookkeeper, and she put her life right next to him doing that bookkeeping. She hated bookkeeping. He liked the store pretty much, but it took sucked up his life, really. My childhood was great. I had a great childhood up until I was a teenager, but we had lots of fun. I had friends over. We had my parents had big parties, and they had me later in life. They were already, I think my dad was 38, and so by the time I got to be a teenager, they were getting tired, and stresses were starting to show up, and cracks were kind of happening in their relationship, and you know, they were spending less time with me. I have a sister who's 9 years older than I am. My sister was kind of cycling through marriages and traumas and all kinds of stuff. And what I learned from that was that there was something wrong with me. I made a conclusion that kids do sometimes when they don't get paid attention to, that there's something wrong with them, that's why they're not being paid attention to. And so what I internalized was some kind of a defect. And what that did was, I was kind of an entitled kid anyway. And so when I went out into the world, I got picked on a fair amount. I was pretty overweight. And so I absorbed a kind of a mindset that told me that I was defective, but people were not very nice. And my dad didn't help me much. One of his sayings was, people are no damn good. But my dad had a lot of sayings that were, you know, he would denigrate various races of people, and then he would go play golf on Saturday with a Jewish guy, a black guy, and a Chinese guy, and a Mexican guy. And I said, why are you saying this about these people? And then you go play golf with these people. These are your friends. He said, oh, they're not like that. So, he gradually changed over the years. But my family lessons were ingrained in me. And when I went through high school and then got out of high school and then was ready to go to college, I met a woman, and this is not uncommon for Al-Anon men. I met a woman, and the amazing thing was that she liked me. And so there's a guy in this program, a great speaker, and one of the things he spoke about was these milestones in his life, meeting his future wife, getting married, having kids, buying a house. And at each juncture of those things, it was, oh, why did you get married? Well, so she'd like me. Why did we have kids? Oh, so that we'd stay married. Why did you buy a house? Oh, so that, you know, he had all these different reasons. None of the reasons were about what he wanted to do. And my life was very much like that. If somebody paid an inordinate amount of attention to me, then we better get married. And so we can hold each other hostage for years. And so that's what I did. And I was a not very good husband. I wasn't unfaithful, but I wasn't there. It wasn't really what I wanted to do. I was kind of off in a corner, inside my head. And my idea of conflict was, oh, let's just get a divorce. And so, because I didn't have any tools, I had no way to, I had no options that I could see. And because I couldn't see options, I only had one. And that was pull the ripcord and get out. And that was a huge bluff, though, because at a certain point, my wife left me. And we were going to move up north. I was going to be a computer programmer and do this stuff with my dad. And we had moved all of our furniture to a little house behind my parents' house. And I was rearranging everything and waiting for her to show up. And after a couple of weeks, she said, "I'm going to go visit my sister." And after 2 weeks, I didn't hear anything. And I was getting ready to call the police, and then she called me up. She said, "I'm never coming back." And my world imploded because I had nothing. I had no program. I had no tools. I had nothing. And so my option was then to just kill myself. And I had an Enfield rifle that a friend of mine had given me, and I had lost the bullets. I couldn't find them. They were somewhere in the house. I looked all over. I couldn't find them. And I wrote a suicide note. I did all that shit. And then I finally thought, maybe there's something else I can do. So I got the phone book out, and I opened the phone book to a random page. And in the middle of the page, in highlighted letters, was the word help and a phone number. So I called that number, and I got this person on the line, and it was the local mental health place. And I said, "I don't know what to do. I'm thinking about killing myself." And they said, "Well, why don't you come over here?" And I said, "Well, I'm so upset I can't drive." And they said, "We're only 2 blocks from your house." So I walked over there. And you know the interesting thing about the place? There's no doorknob on the inside of the door. So the door closed, and I sat down, and they said, "Would you like to talk to somebody?" And I said, "I've never talked to anybody before." And they said, "Okay, well, this woman came out, and she sat me down, and we talked for 5 hours. That was the first miracle, the first real miracle I had had. And I core dumped everything. And that person, now we can talk about the first step. This is where I really admitted that I was powerless over my life and that my life was unmanageable. I was working the first step without knowing that there was a first step. And so I, you know, that cracked the egg. I was able to have more options, and the reason that I had more options was because I had surrendered. When you surrender, not you, when I surrender, I have options. When I hold on tight and I try and fix it myself, I usually only have one option. That's turn the bolt until it breaks. I talked to a mechanic one time, and I said, "I'm worried about this bolt. How tight can I tighten this bolt before it breaks?" And he said, "You can tighten it a half an inch after it breaks and then back up." Helpful. So after that, I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. And that power was the therapist. And for many years, I went to therapy. And therapy did help me. But it didn't help me all the way. I was still isolated. I was still by myself. I was still dependent on my own mind to help myself. And that's not working. That was not working. So the third step is made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. I had no God at that time because my father was a lapsed Catholic, an angry lapsed Catholic. We had long discussions in my family about God not existing. And so I went to Methodist church because my parents said it was close and I needed something, you know, some civilizing influence, I suppose, you know. So, but it didn't mean anything to me. And so my higher power was version 1.0. And at that time, that higher power just didn't exist for me. So I will loop back to that. Let's talk about step four. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. It wasn't until many years later that I was in the program that I actually worked a fourth step. And the fourth step for me, I've done this a number of times. It is, again, another way of seeing who I am. When I started in this program, I didn't know who I was. I could go to the supermarket and stand for an hour and look at cereal, because I didn't know what my cereal was. I have three kinds of cereal. I know exactly what they are. Those are my cereals. I'm open to other cereals, but those are mine. Those are mine. But I didn't know who I was. I knew that if you knew something that you liked, I'd like that. I'll take that. If you want to go to a movie, I don't know what movie I want to go to. I'll go to the movie you want to go to. The problem with that is if I don't know who I am, then I want to glom onto who you are. I want to crawl up inside your head and be you, because I'm not happy with being myself. That's a very bad place for me to be. So having an inventory is a way for me to put down what I can about myself and then look at it and say, yes, this is who I am. And this is a good thing. So, you know, the fifth step, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. This took me a long time too. This is more the recent part of my life. Admitting to God isn't so hard. Admitting to another person isn't so hard. Admitting to myself is hard. Because for a very long time, I thought that whatever faults I had were proofs of my worthlessness. And so this is where my higher power had to have an upgrade. And so we'll call this higher power 2.0. Higher power 2.0 tells me that my faults are not proofs of my worthlessness, because I have worth, and that everyone is born with worth. It's as if you were born and God slipped a gold coin in your pocket. And that gold coin never tarnishes, and you never lose it, and no one can ever take it away from you. And so everyone has that worth. If everyone has that worth, then people are not a no damn good. Everyone is good because they have that worth. What that does is it puts me in a position where I can't judge anybody. The worst thing that can happen to me is when I hate somebody. And there are people on TV that I don't like. And I've gotten into that hating them kind of thing. And the advice that I get from sponsors is to pray for that person. And it's hard when you know, there are some people that are really hateable. They really have that ability to be hated. But what that does is it refutes my worth when I hate others. It tells me that we don't have that value, but we do. That's my core belief. And to have that core belief means that I have to pray for that person. I don't have to like what they do, but I have to love them for their value. And that's part of, you will love us even though we don't like you. You will love us in a very special way. There are people who I have loved in a very special way in this program. There was a guy, his name was, we called him Sleeveless Steve. And he was not an easy person to love. He was obnoxious, he was big, he was scary, And I hired him. I talked to him and I said, I know you've got the skills and I know you need the job. And you want to work for me, it's okay, we'll give it a try. And what I had to do, that was a gift to me to be able to stand up to a big scary guy and say, we're going to do it this way. And you need to do it this way. And we worked it out. And, one day, he worked for me for a couple of years, and he didn't show up one day because he died. And I spoke at his funeral, and his parents said, we didn't really understand how much you loved him till you spoke. And I learned how to love him in that special way. Loving somebody in a special way doesn't mean you grudgingly love somebody. It means that you love their core. And when you love someone's core, you're right there. You may not like the way they part their hair, but you love them. So, where are we now? Let's see. Number six. Okay. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. This is, to me, about letting go. I have a number of defects. Leah can tell you what they are. and I tell myself what they are. And I remember after I got divorced the first time, I really felt worthless. I really that was a very dark time for me. And I knew that there were aspects of my personality that I really hated. I really, really hated him. And if I could have gotten rid of those, I would have dumped him at the side of the road. But they were not going away. I was entirely ready, but I didn't have a higher power that could help me, because I had a higher power 2.0. So I had to upgrade. And I used this program to upgrade my higher power. And so I went to higher power 3.0. And it's about surrendering. The thing about surrendering for me is that when I surrender, I have many options. If I'm working on my motorcycle and I'm trying to turn a bolt and it's sticking, and right then what I'm thinking about is, I want this bolt to go all the way in. I'm just going to give it a lot more torque. And I stop most of the time. I stop. And I go, I give up. I can't do this. I can't make this happen. And when I stop, when I do that, it's really weird. Other ideas start to filter into my head. Well, maybe you can heat it up. Maybe you can hit it with a hammer. Maybe you can put some penetrating oil on it. Maybe you can do, there's like 20 different things that come up if I let go of forcing. If I can let go of that, then the options come. And this is about the defects of character. If I can surrender that I have them, then I can let them go. It's like the, I won't tell you about the frog in the airplane, but I'll tell you about the monkey in the bottle. This is a really old story. This guy had a monkey, and he put some nuts in a bottle. And the monkey reaches down and he grabs the nuts and he can't get out. He can't get out because he doesn't want to let go of the nuts. And so he's stuck. And so what happens is, until the monkey decides that he can let go of all the big handful of nuts and just take one, he can get his arm out of the bottle. But unless he surrenders and isn't so greedy, he's stuck. So that was like me. I had to let go. I had to stop grabbing on to my solution and accept other solutions. And so those defects of character, I don't believe that they ever completely go away, because I believe they're a gift. I believe that my defects have been given to me by my higher power. And they've been given to me for me to grow. And so they get to sit at the table with my emotions. We have a big table, but I have the menu. I order. They don't get to order. My rational decisions should not be made by my defects or my emotions. And I can only do that if I surrender. So humbly ask them to remove our shortcomings. And that's, again, surrender. I have to trust that my higher power has given me these things and that I can allow them to be part of me, but not be me. So now we are at 8. Made a list of all persons we had harmed, became willing to make amends to them all. This is another surrender step for me, because I had to surrender the shame of having hurt people and the shame of maybe being judged, so that I could put these people on a list. And then to make direct amends to them, to such people, wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. I had a situation where my son wanted to live with us, and we couldn't do that. He was in high school, and he decided he would stop talking to me. And he stopped talking to me for over 10 years. And so I was too stubborn to contact him, and he was too stubborn to contact me. And my wife Leah and his wife, he had just gotten married, got together, and they reintroduced us to each other. And, you know, I sat down with him after we were reintroduced, and I made amends. And the interesting thing was, I had a whole list of things that I had was ashamed of, that I had done, that I felt badly about. He said, you know, I don't remember those things, Dad. And I said, well, what do you remember? And he said, I remember when I was in high school, you bought me a trail bike. And you didn't have enough money to buy one for yourself, so you only bought one. But you went out with me when I rode it, and you sat and you watched me ride around. That's what I remember. And I said, well, I don't remember that all that well. But the crux of it was that he had things and I had things. And the things that were eating at me, he didn't even remember those. Those weren't all that important to him. But what is important is that we have a relationship, and that we text back and forth. And he sent me a picture of his breakfast the other day. I don't know, biscuits and gravy, you know, it's his thing. But to be able to do that made it so that we could have a relationship without stuff in the background. And I tried to do that. Continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. I do this fairly often. I don't do it perfectly, but to be able to review what I'm thinking, what I'm doing. Leah and I have a daughter, stepdaughter. It's my stepdaughter. It's her daughter, Danielle. We've struggled with Danielle for many, many years. She has got all kinds of problems. And there are times when my involvement in helping has made it a much, much worse situation. And we ran into a situation where I really felt like things weren't going the way I wanted to go. And so I was thinking, oh, I'm going to just pull the ripcord and just get a divorce. And instead of doing that, I called Roger. And Roger talked to me, and the interesting thing was, he didn't talk to me about my situation. He talked to me about something that happened to him. And while he was talking, I can't even tell you what he was saying, because he was just going on and on. But while he was talking, I began to realize one of the things that he said was, "She, you are not a woman, and you cannot understand what it's like to have a daughter. You cannot conceive of that concept because that's not who you are. You have to accept that there's certain things that you cannot understand the nuances of. And a mother-daughter relationship is not something that you can fully understand. So stop meddling in it. Stop trying to help, because your help is making it worse, which is what Al-Anons do the best. We help and make things worse." And so I came to Leah and I said, "I'm very sorry. I want you to understand that you are the boss. You are the boss of this relationship. Whatever you want to do, I will support you. Whatever you want to show me, talk to me about, I will listen. But your opinion is the final opinion. Whatever you think we should do, we should do." And the interesting thing is, things got better. Things got a lot better. It's not easy. It's very difficult with her. But she's still in the same place. She has a roof over her head. She hasn't been thrown out. She was getting evicted every 60 to 30 days. She was homeless at one point. She's not homeless now. I mean, she's difficult. She's a difficult person. But she has that value. She has that value. And she is loved. So, you know, I have a hard time loving her, but I'm getting there. So through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him. Praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. This is where I want to talk about my new higher power. I'm at higher power 3.6. This is a really good one. There's always an upgrade, but this is a good one because my previous higher powers, higher power 1.0 was like a distant, cold star that you can just barely see. Higher power 2.0 was like the moon. You get some light off of it and it's there, but it's not very close. This higher power I can see in the dark shadows of the trees when I meditate. This higher power sits under the leaves when the water rolls off of them when it rains. It's in the background, it's there. Now my higher power is never going to take care of my parking tickets. It's never gonna fix my computer. It's never gonna get me a raise. My higher power is the break glass, pull lever variety. But that's fine, that's okay. You know, I had a situation where I had a biopsy and I got really sick. I got an infection. And at one point, I was in a huge amount of discomfort. And I knew that I had 3 hours to go before I could call the doctor. And Leah was exhausted. I didn't want to wake her up. But the pain and the discomfort was so extreme that I thought I was going to just lose it. And so I prayed to my higher power and I said, "Look, I get that you can't stop this pain. I get it. That's fine. Give me something so I can get through those 3 hours. Give me something." And it's, as soon as I said that, something happened and I could do it. I still felt all the pain, but I could do it. And I made it those 3 hours. Leah drove me to the doctor. We stopped at every red light. That was a very long drive, very long drive. But I had what I needed to get there. And so I have a prayer. It's non-conference approved, so if you don't like that, now you have a gift of resentment. But this prayer really communicates to me, it works for me when I have to really pull the fire alarm and ask for exactly what I need. And I'm going to read this to you now. This is a prayer that was found on the body of a guy named Andre Zernheld. He was a lieutenant in a commando unit in Libya in 1942. And they were attacking the Germans from the desert. And they were badass dudes, these guys. So he wrote this prayer. And they use this now, the French Metropolitan Marine Infantry paratroopers use this prayer. So here it is. I'm asking you, God, to give me what you have left. Give me those things which others never ask of you. I don't ask you for rest or tranquility, not that of the spirit, the body, or the mind. I don't ask you for wealth or success or even health. All those things are asked of you so much that you can't have any left to give. Give me instead what you have left. Give me what others don't want. I want uncertainty and doubt. I want torment and fear. And I ask that you give them to me now and forever so that I can be sure to have them, because I won't always have the strength to ask again. But give me also the courage, the energy, and the spirit to face them. I ask that you give these things because I can't ask them for myself. This prayer for me is like when things are as bad as they can be, bring it on. Bring it on, because you'll also bring on what I need to get through those things. And so, you know, this is not the prayer you have when you win the lottery, but it's the prayer that I need for the faith that I have. So now, we're having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. We tried to carry this message to others and to practice these principles in all our affairs. I have had a spiritual awakening. It was about the quietest, most subtle sort of thing that you could imagine. I meditate every day, and I stare out into the world, and I say the Serenity Prayer, and then I listen for what I can get. And what I got was a very clear voice that said, "You're included." That was it. That was the spiritual awakening. But that was precisely what I needed, because all my life, I felt not included. I was the last guy that got picked for the baseball team. I was the guy that, you know, got pushed aside when they went to, you know, get stuff at the cafeteria. I didn't feel included. In this group, I am supremely included. I feel more included in the world than I've ever felt. And it's not just because of this group, it's also because of this higher power. It's because of the love of Leah. It's because of, the ability to see that value in people, in all people, and struggle to honor that value. So carrying this message to others is a privilege. I've talked to a number of people who were who needed this program but couldn't figure out how to ask for it, so I could say something about things that I do and that helps them. And I'm honored to be able to do that. I'm also honored to be able to be here and to make it this far. And I'm looking very forward to Higher Power 3.7. So we'll see. I don't know if I'm supposed to stop now or keep going. What's the deal? Two more minutes. Okay, all right. Two more minutes. Well, there's a frog and it gets on an airplane. No, I don't know that one. But anyway, I think that it's a challenging world that we're in right now. There's so many things that I see in the news and on the TV that get me going and make me feel despairing in what's going on. And then I have to realize that I have to back up and see things with a certain perspective. And one of the great powers of this program is that I can change my perspective. And I do that because I get yours. I get to see your perspective. And it's always different than mine, and it's always a refreshing experience for me. The worst thing I can do is cling to my sense of knowing what I ought to do, because I don't know what I should do. I need others. And to not have that input, I would be lost in the wilderness. So I thank you for listening to me, and I love you all. Yeah.